Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Solera Report. We have a special treat today. This is Dr. Meryl Nass, who needs no introduction at the Solera Report. We are recording on July 11th. We're here to talk about biowarfare, the rise of pathogen plunder with Dr. Nass. And I do want to mention that you've just come off an incredible period of starting Door to Freedom and great success at pushing back on the World Health Organization. You have a very deep history in biodefense, biowarfare, more than anyone I know, and you speak very eloquently on it, Meryl. And so it's a real privilege to have you on the Solera Report to talk about this, because I know of no better person to help bring a layperson sort of up to speed and give them a framework on what's happening and what how to think about this. And this is going to be an incredibly important topic going forward. So I'm very grateful you're here.
Hey, thank you so much for inviting me. I'm very honored to be here.
Okay. And we're going to get to it at the end, but Meryl has a new initiative through Door for Freedom on food. And food is right at the heart of the biowarfare story. So we'll come back around and what I'm going to ask you all to do is to support Meryl and what she's doing in food, because it's very, very wonderful. Okay, so what is biowarfare? I made a list of all the words: biodefense, biowarfare, biosurveillance, bioterror, and then, of course, all the variations: biological, chemical, radiology. I don't even know how to say that, radiological and nuclear. Okay, so this, there's a whole portfolio of things. So do you usually refer to it as biowarfare or biodefense?
I think it's biowarfare, and biodefense was what the name got changed to after Nixon declared that the United States was no longer going to engage in offensive biological warfare programs. So we switched over to biodefense at that point. We were going to prepare for other people's biowarfare and their agents. But unfortunately, during the Clinton administration, at least, the United States decided to reinterpret what it was allowed to do and not allowed to do according to the Biological Weapons Treaty, which Nixon had initiated and went into force in 1975. So by the 1990s, the United States was already thinking, we don't really want to get rid of all of biological warfare. We just want to do it our way.
And I would say, just from looking at the numbers, the United States has by far and away the biggest biowarfare capability or capacity, or certainly spends the most money compared to all the other nations around the world.
So that's likely to be true, but because there's a treaty that says no, you cannot do research or produce offensive biological weapons, nobody admits to doing that.
Right.
And so there are no numbers to really compare. It was what is called gain of function has that strange name because it used to be called biowarfare research, is making microorganisms more transmissible, more virulent, more deadly, make them infect more organs or more different kinds of animals. That gain of function was considered, you know, verboten, prohibited, initially when the Biological Weapons Convention was established in the 70s. But what happened was the treaty, that it was a treaty, big treaty, 180 some signatories in the world. It was done in relative hurry, and the nations were going to plan in future how to create a regimen for inspections and for punishments. So even though a treaty was created, you could breach the treaty, you could transgress it, and if nobody knew, you'd get away with it. There was no punishments, no inspections, no way of dealing with people who didn't go along with the treaty. Efforts were made in the 1990s, efforts were made for a long time to try to put all that together and to add provisions to the treaty to strengthen it. And the United States in 2000 put the kibosh on it, 2000 or 2001, said, walked away from what was pretty much a settled deal on how to strengthen this treaty. What we found out in the book Germs, which came out in September of 2001, was that, in fact, the Clinton administration had been transgressing the treaty,
right,
and playing around with various anthrax programs that most scientists thought it shouldn't be doing. But we also knew that in 1979, 4 years after the treaty went into force, the Soviet Union had a leak of anthrax, and that led to over 100 cases and about 60 deaths of people mm-hmm. from anthrax from a factory that would have been prohibited, should have been prohibited by the Biological Weapons Convention. So basically, it was known that countries were not following the treaty. Nobody knew what to do with it. And then the United States put the kibosh on strengthening the treaty. And it's only now, after COVID and us realizing that this was either an escape or a deliberate use of a lab-created organism, that countries are starting to come together again and say, what can we do treaty-wise to stop this from happening in the future?
So let me just step back a couple of things before we go into the history, more history of it. One of the things that it's very important to understand, I think when most people hear the word biowarfare or biodefense, they think of biological or pathogens targeted at humans. But in fact, we know a lot of the history here has been targeting food supplies, whether Correct. It's crops, whether it's soil, whether it's livestock. And if you look at the history of this as a tactic, it's deeply involved with the question of food and competitors, you know, political competitors, food supply.
Right. And not only political, but economic competitors.
Right.
It's very important to know that, for instance, during World War II, when the United States had a very active offensive biological weapons program, we were developing organisms to target the rice crop in Japan,
right,
to target, you know, cattle in Germany. And so low-intensity warfare has probably often involved the use of chemical and biological weapons against livestock and crops.
Right.
And the use of insect pests was also part of the U.S. program at one time.
So I made a list of all the mechanisms, you know, so if you go back through history, here's some of the mechanisms. Obviously, you put it in the water, you spray it overhead, you put it in the food. So you're not only trying to target and destroy food, but you're also using food as a medium to deliver. Injections, insects. I couldn't believe it. I did not know the word. You're going to have to teach me how to pronounce it. Entomological warfare? Is that
entomology? Yeah, entomological.
So there is a long history of using insects and mosquitoes and other little critters to deliver this stuff. And we know Bill Gates is very enthusiastic on using them to deliver vaccines. So and other stuff. And then, of course, infected people or corpses. Throughout the Middle Ages, they used to throw the infected corpse over the wall. Okay, so let's look at the history. I was reminded by, once again, revisiting the history. This is very ancient. This has been going on. Biowarfare has been going on since recorded history. Is that fair to say?
Well, dead bodies were thrown into wells to
right.
poison the water of the enemy. And as you said, the Black Death came when the Genoans were living in, I guess, what is now Crimea, and had a walled city, and they were attacked by, I think, Mongols, I'm not sure about that, who did use these actual devices to fling dead corpses over the wall. This was, I think, in the 1300s. And then the Genoans, you know, got in their boats and went back to Italy and spread the Black Death. So
right.
the plague. And by the way, that plague we actually have plague in the United States. It is in rodents in the southwest of the United States. And there's usually a handful of people who get the plague. It's a bacterial illness. Antibiotics can work. Not too many people die from it, but it still is around. And it is transmitted through, rats and fleas and
right.
such.
So lots of ancient history, but coming into the 20th century, one of the things that happens is we really do get a revolution in the technology that people can use. So tell us a little bit about, in the 20th and 21st century, what has happened technologically to revolutionize biowarfare?
Well, I guess germs were discovered, you know, in the late 1800s. So there were no longer these invisible things that were just happening to us from the ether. And people quickly started to figure out how to make vaccines against these germs. So Pasteur was in the 1880s. This goes back a long way. And people realized that they could grow germs and use them. So in World War I, it is said that the Germans were actually using biological agents against the horses of the enemy that were trying to smuggle them in. And in World War II, the Germans were not doing biological warfare in World War II. It was said that Hitler didn't believe in it, but the Japanese were. So the Japanese had a huge program of testing all sorts of biological agents. And using American POWs, Australian POWs, and local Chinese people that were just kidnapped as guinea pigs. But the United States also had a program. And then in the 1950s and 60s, particularly after the Vietnam War started, Seventh-day Adventists, who were conscientious objectors, the elders of their religion basically told the government that their conscientious objector young men could go to Fort Detrick and be human guinea pigs instead for biological weapons. And that was called Project White Coat or Operation White Coat.
Around the catwalk into these cubicles. And that's where you will see us put our head down into this area where they strapped us in so we could not move. And within a few seconds, the exposure was over with.
The tests were conducted in such a manner that each volunteer received a precisely metered dosage of the organism.
As the Cold War began heating up in the early 1950s, there was a concern that the Soviet Union would develop biological weapons. Weapons far more dangerous than those developed by the Japanese in World War II.
These aerosols could be spread over large areas. Submarines could release aerosols near coastal cities. Specially designed germ-carrying bombs could be dropped.
Seventh-day Adventist church leaders said, yes, this is an acceptable way to serve. What better way to serve than to help save lives, not only on the battlefield as medics, but saving lives in a much wider, broader way?
This is a story about big organization, big institution, a human system that actually did things in a smart way, did it well, and did it ethically.
This is the story of their commitment to their religious and patriotic duties, a story of their extraordinary courage, and a story of their contributions. Contributions, as you will see, that went far beyond biodefense for the U.S. military.
And yeah, so there were hundreds of Seventh-day Adventists who served as guinea pigs for the U.S. program until it was shut down in the early 70s.
I never heard that. That's incredible.
Yeah, I actually worked with somebody who was in the program. An anthrax vaccine was tested on them also as one of the things.
One of the things that happened was that we see with the consolidation of the global currency system into the dollar and the development of a black budget and a series of things that we've talked plenty about on the Solari Report, a rising tsunami of cheap money available to do this kind of, to build an infrastructure, to yes. do this kind of research and develop technologies to use. So part of the story of sort of, because it seems to me that biowarfare is going to a whole new level. And part of that is there's just an enormous amount of funding and a preference for using invisible weaponry instead of conventional weaponry.
Right. I absolutely agree with you. I think there are so many different invisible attacks on us. And, you know, personally, I think that's one thing we need to go after legislatively, is that you can't, is to stop the legality of all this. For instance, you don't know, you know, what is inside of a vaccine is invisible to us.
Right.
And it's almost impossible to take a vial of vaccine and figure out what's in it. But what's in your food is invisible. What's in the air is invisible. What's in the water is invisible. And air and water are our commons, and yet we are allowing people to despoil these commons with no charge, no crime, you know, not even defining what they are allowed or not allowed to do. You know, airplanes are only allowed to go so low, you know, and drones have to be in a certain space, but electromagnetic waves are allowed to go everywhere.
Right.
And this is something that where the technology is getting ahead of us, and we have a system where Congress can't deal with all these things.
So you said a brilliant thing about this, and you're absolutely right, that part of what is happening with this explosion of investment and activity in this area is that there is a hubris of the people doing it, which is, it's very hard to fathom until you come into touch with it. So tell us a little bit about that hubris.
Well, my impression from watching what happened during COVID is that people who are somehow see themselves as rulers of the planet and who were the ones coming up with the orders that all our nation's leaders followed, you know, to restrict the hydroxychloroquine and ivermectin and vitamin D and zinc, and to insist on remdesivir and, you know, insist on these dangerous vaccines, keep people locked in their homes, all shut the schools. All of that was coming from some place that we don't know. You know, we don't know who, we don't know how, but we know that it came because all of our leaders essentially followed along. And those same people are, it seems, are very interested in prolonging life expectancy and in changing the food supply so that there are crazy experiments going on, you know, that in which some people think they might be able to live forever or live for 200 years or freeze their brain or put their brain into the cloud, you know, and have it manage things after they're dead. I read an article that yesterday of DARPA trying to come up with food out of the air, actually pulling carbon dioxide and minerals out of the air to produce food so they could have an army, you know, fighting somewhere and producing the food without having to schlep it all the way right there. So what I mean by all this is that the hubris is enormous, as if we have such great science and technology at this point that we can actually accomplish these goals. Most of these goals are crazy. They don't realize, yeah, you can create 5G, 6G, 7G, but, you know, with very simple guns, you know, with a pellet gun or with a shotgun, you can shoot down these 5G towers. Right. They're not very high up. They're easy to get you. You know, with a paint gun, you can take one of these robots and wipe out their sensors. Right. And they haven't realized that the infrastructure to create this brave new world that people are talking about is very, very, is not durable, very fragile. It's not going to happen because we're not going to allow it to happen. But they think it's coming.
part of the hubris is that they believe, you know, they keep getting away with it.
Yes.
And so if you look at the financial fraud and you go back, you know, they would get away with $25 million and they're like, wow, we got away. Okay, let's try 50. And, you know, it got worse and worse and worse. And then it really just went out of control and the hubris became unbelievable. Now, I just finished reading a very impactful statement by a historian in France. His name is Emmanuel Todd. And he was talking about, I've never understood Merrill when I saw the hubris in Washington sort of go out of control in the 90s. What happened? Why did that happen? And I knew the rape of Russia had triggered a lot of hubris and sort of ridiculous behavior, but I didn't attribute the whole wave to that. And he said that the primary cause of the hubris at that time was the extraordinary success of the rape of Russia. And they kind of got drunk on it. And I think a combination of the financial fraud and then a combination of the invisible weaponry, like what we're talking about now, and then the success of what they would call hybrid warfare at the time, it just all went to their heads. And you were dealing with people who were drunk on power.
Yes.
And you just, their behavior, you knew their behavior was such that it couldn't go the distance.
Yes. And the social sciences were, and the surveillance was increasing. So they really were able to control a lot of people's minds. You know, they
right.
were, even though they took over the media and people realized the media were not giving us the truth, people were still watching, you know, people, we all still have our cell phones. So
I started to look at this in the 90s when I started to deal with a kind of physical harassment. And I couldn't understand the things that were happening. And some of them appeared to be what people at the time were calling directed energy weaponry. And so I started to really research what was going on. And I talked to a lot of the so-called targeted individuals. And what I discovered was there was appeared to be a huge business of sort of private intelligence agencies helping real estate landlords target and get tenants out of rent-controlled apartments, or doing other things that would cause them to dramatically improve rents in their building. And so these yes. weapons weren't just being used by government. They were being used by businesses in ways that made them a ton of money. And,
yes.
And poisoning, you know, it's funny because I had experiences with poisoning and I started to look into the history of poisoning. And it turned out to be far more common than I had ever understood. And when I say common, I don't just mean, you know, governments using it, all sorts of people using it. And, you know, and it, you know, in a sense, it's a scary topic because when you realize how, I don't know if the right word is, how ubiquitous this technology is, it's quite, it's, we're not just talking about governments here. We're talking about an enormous amount of non-state actors, private intelligence agencies, mercenaries, everything else. We're talking about organized crime.
Right. So what we used to have is the government did all of this stuff and nobody else was allowed to do it. It was illegal
right.
for other people to do it. And then somebody decided, and I think this may have started in the 90s, but you can help me, that the government should outsource to contractors.
Right. Right.
And the contractors started getting paid three times what government employees would be paid. But the information, so you've been very central in pointing out how Lockheed, for instance, is doing the books for most of the government agencies. So somehow all this government information and weapons got outsourced also. And again, who made the decision that it was okay to do that?
I'll tell you who made the decision. In 1981, so we had the black budget. And we had the sort of hidden system of finance. It was all happening and growing. But the thing that set it off exponentially is in 1981, when Bush became the vice president, his deal with Reagan was he would run the National Security Council, the Department of Justice, and the intelligence agencies. So he had national security, enforcement, and intelligence. And he got an executive order done in 1981 that classified projects could be outsourced to corporations, which connected the borrowing capacity of the Treasury with the stock market and to finance classified projects. So the more money you poured into corporations, the more capital gains profits you could generate for investors, and you could literally take the entire black budget private if you wanted to. Right. And that, you know, so suddenly you have a spigot that can create infinite amount of profits in corporations and banks. And then you've got every entrepreneur you can think of marketing their latest idea. You know, one of the reasons you get folks thinking they can do more than they can do is everybody wants to feed at that trough, and they're marketing right. all these ideas and making all these promises of what you can and cannot do, which brings us to anthrax. Because it was interesting when I looked, I wanted to look at what was the GDP for U.S. biowarfare. How big is this business? And so I looked, and what I was amazed. If you look at sort of the key market segments, it's not high tech at all. It's anthrax, smallpox. Smallpox has hundreds of years history, and botulism, and then others. But so let's go, because I think of you as knowing more about anthrax than just about anybody. Tell us how you became one of the world's leading experts on anthrax.
So I walked into the wrong room at the wrong time. I went to a meeting of, when I was in my 30s, Physicians for Social Responsibility, and this was in Amherst, Massachusetts. Students were taking a course and looking at Pentagon contracts, and they claimed the Pentagon was doing germ warfare, but they didn't really know, and they wanted our group to investigate. And in particular, there was a professor who was studying anthrax vaccines. I didn't know anything about anthrax or Pentagon contracts at the university. And I said, you know what? I don't think vaccine research is biowarfare, germ warfare research, and I'm not sure we should get involved with this. And so the men there were like, oh, this dumb broad, she doesn't know anything. Of course we do that. And so they said, well, why don't you read the contract? And so I said, okay, I will. And the contract had nothing to do with vaccines. It was a fake name. It was about a primitive form of genetic engineering of anthrax. I found out later the person who had this, in those days, this is 35 years ago, had a $500,000 contract, was a former Fort Detrick employee. He'd spent his whole life working on anthrax. And when Fort Detrick had gone to biodefense, he came to UMass, along with three of his colleagues. And so I was interested in why they were lying about what his research was about. He'd never done any vaccine research. Why was it titled vaccine research? Francis Crowe, a famous Quaker activist, also was there. And she got the Quakers, the Friends Committee on National Legislation, you know, those groups to pay for a guy who just graduated college, also a wonderful activist, John Boniface. And he started sending out Freedom of Information Act requests. And she and I started gathering up all of this information about the U.S. biowarfare program, because the Quakers had been interested in that back when it was offensive, had been fighting it. Mm-hmm. And it was fascinating. So I just started like reading everything and then driving to all the libraries in Massachusetts to, in those days, you know, we didn't have everything on the internet. So I would be reading the microfiche in the basement of the UMass library. And anyway, I just, you know, anthrax was, there was one case a decade in the United States at that point. So nobody knew anything about anthrax unless you were in biological warfare. And I essentially was able to read everything that was published on anthrax in those days. So I was reading magazines from the Boston Journal of Medicine, the precursor of the New England Journal of Medicine, from the 1830s.
Wow.
Reports of anthrax. And the pages were crumbling in my hands. So anyway, then as soon as I'd got done doing that, it took me about three. What happened was I wasn't only interested, but I realized pretty quickly that the United States was breaching the law on, or what we thought was the law, their mission statement and claims that were made about where the law was on offensive versus defensive research. And in addition, I decided to study all the recent anthrax epidemics, and I found one in Rhodesia during its civil war that was clearly biological warfare, and I felt an obligation to write a paper and prove it. So it took me 3 years to get all the information and find a way to prove it. And so I published several papers during that time. Those were my first real papers. You know, I was maybe 40 years old. And then the Gulf War started, and all of a sudden everybody was interested in anthrax, you know. And then after that, it was Gulf War syndrome. And then it was 9/11 and the anthrax vaccine program. So in 10 years, anthrax exploded from nothing to being a major concern. And that's what happened to me.
And my impression was at that time, there, the record of the anthrax vaccine, it was one of the worst vaccines ever.
It was unbelievably horrible. And we tried very hard to stop it. I mean, I spent almost all my waking hours trying to stop it when I wasn't seeing patients for about 5 years. And we actually, a group I worked with, got the license revoked for about 18 months. And then FDA just gave the license back with no required data. And when we appealed, we got the Chevron deference answer, which was the FDA has deference. We don't care about your science. You don't get to present the science in court.
Now, so, has Chevron changed? Is there hope to reverse that?
Yes. Yes.
Right. Okay. So, but for some reason, the targeting of some of the senators and some of the legislators with anthrax really put the word anthrax in people's minds in a way that it had never been before.
Correct.
Right.
So anthrax is a sort of a quintessential biological weapon. If you get enough of it into your lungs, it's quite deadly unless you get antibiotics quickly. It does not spread person to person, so that you can use it on one person, or you can use it on one island or in one part of a country, and you know only the people and the animals in that place. The animals ingest it. The cattle browse. If there's anthrax in the soil under certain odd weather conditions, it will sort of repopulate in the superficial soil and animals will die from it. But otherwise, it really isn't a problem. As I said, we have almost one case a decade in the United States, usually from beating on an African drum made of the skin of an animal that died of anthrax. You need a lot of spores for a human, probably at least 50,000 spores to contract it. So it's very hard to contract. But it was used in Rhodesia. Rhodesia was split into areas of black and white habitation. So you knew if you put it in a black area, there would be no white people there.
Right.
And so that's what was done. It was primarily used to kill cattle belonging to black people in Rhodesia as a form of low-intensity warfare, economic warfare.
So I'll never forget when I first started to dive into this topic, John Rappaport said something that really struck me, and he said, they far prefer chemical warfare because they can target it. And the problem with many forms of biological warfare is it's very hard to control.
Right, which is why they chose anthrax, because it's like a chemical agent. You want something that does not spread person to person. Well, it depends what, you know, or you want to use it on an island like Cuba. So
right.
Cubans say the United States has used a number of different agents.
Well, they've gone to the UN through the Russians and tried to make a case that we're doing it.
Yes. They even have the tail number of planes that flew over that they believe dropped stuff, insects and other things. But there are other microorganisms that you can use in that way as well that don't spread person to person.
So something happened in the 90s, and that was we started to see lots of spraying going on in the sky.
Yes.
You know, spraying, and it's been going all over the planet. And the question always has been, what is in this stuff? Some of the things in it have been heavy metals, but some of the things have been what we just had Clifford Carnicombe on the Salieri Report. He would describe, he's got an acronym for them, biological. It's something like synthetic biological materials. And if you look at the fibers that come out of people's bodies with Morgellons disease, that is an example of what he's calling a synthetic. It's it's almost like it's living synthetic biological material, if you can imagine that. It's what he describes. But what he said in this interview is he believes it's, he's, because he's been looking at the injections, he believes it's the same materials as are in the injections.
So, you know, we don't know what there are different ways people have tried to figure out what's in these planes, what is in the chemtrails, and who's doing it and why.
Right.
So I've heard other stories that it's, you know, fly ash from burning coal or burning other things that's very toxic. It's a way to get rid of toxins, just as I believe, I can't prove this, but there's a lot of circumstantial evidence that the United States took nuclear waste and mixed it with depleted uranium. Depleted uranium is when you take out the U-235 to make weapons or to make nuclear fuel. You've got depleted uranium, which is only half as radioactive as it was initially. And that's what we use to make shielding for tanks, and we use it for bullets and for larger munitions. It can turn into like dust. It can catch on fire very easily, this stuff. And so anyway, the stuff that comes out of, say, a nuclear power plant or a nuclear weapons facility, but particularly a nuclear power plant that has new radioactive isotopes in it that have been created as a result of the nuclear reactions that it's undergone, that material appears to have been mixed in with a depleted uranium, even though it's much more highly radioactive, because it's a way to get rid of it.
Right.
And so anyway, I, you know, there's a lot of different planes flying around spraying things. So some of it is what is acknowledged to be geoengineering, and governments talk about it. Our government admits that they are doing weather modification. You know, they want to make rain. So they're injecting silver nitrate and then other things into clouds to make rain. But there's obviously a lot more to it. It's happening all around the West. I don't know if it happens in Russia or China, but I don't think we really understand who's doing it, who's given, you know, it's the same thing as COVID. Who gave the orders?
If you look at control of the airspace, it's under DOD and FAA. So they can't do it without permission of those two groups. So
exactly. But it's happening all over Europe.
Oh, yes, absolutely.
Right. So what I'm saying is that there's some supranational entity that is allowing for this. It must be very expensive because airplanes are very expensive. Is it all airplanes, or are they using directed energy weapons or HAARP or something else to trigger weather? I think some of it clearly, if you start from the other end and you say, if I'm a general, what kind of weapons would I want to have?
Right.
I would definitely want to be able to control weather.
Right.
And so I think there's no question that there is, that there are military weather weapons, and there's no question that there's cloud seeding. Now, we only know about what they had in the, they were cloud seeding in the 1950s.
Right.
Now it's 2024. So what have they done for the last 70 years? What have they got? There's probably all sorts of things they've got.
Well, it's back to what you were saying about the legal framework. We have this huge portfolio of phenomena that is all invisible or relatively invisible. It's operating directly in our homes, on our bodies. And one, we don't have a good understanding of it. And two, we don't have a legal framework to back it up and deal with it. And that's what has to be done. Okay, so you mentioned the telecommunications. Of course, one of the speculations, whether it's, you know, things involving frequency and electronics can be interacting with these various materials. So one of the great interviews we had, and I think you watched Huber on Financial Rebellion, we had Professor Huber, who's emeritus at, I think it's Purdue, and he was researching what was in the food. He was looking at GMO ingredients, and he found mysterious ingredients that he had no he couldn't identify what they were or where they came from. You know, it was one of the most interesting parts of that interview on the Soleri Report. And you listen to it and you realize, wait a minute, we have mysterious ingredients in the pharmaceuticals. We have mysterious ingredients in the sky. We have mysterious ingredients in the food. And, you know, and there's a lot of speculation as what they're doing in our body and how it changes or affects us. But it's many people believe that it's interacting with the cellular technology. So do you have any thoughts on that, or are there any sort? Yeah, so we're back to the unanswered questions of everything. Right. Right. And as you say, the waves come through. There's no way to keep them out. Anyway, okay. But if you interestingly enough, if you look at the business of biowarfare or biodefense, most of what we're talking about in terms of money is coming from the government. Is this taxpayers' funding? So we're funding this.
Yes, that's the critical thing, is that we're funding it. We do in some way, we have the ability to stop it.
Right.
And that's critically important. I mean, obviously, it's a hard road to get there.
Right.
But people have to realize this is your money. It's actually right. The money that's being borrowed from your children and grandchildren.
Right.
That is making this war on us.
Right. And to me, the money is one way to do it. I just wanted to mention, in terms of the U.S. building a global empire and using this as a tactic, I wanted to mention the cholera in Haiti. And cholera is something we've seen in numerous places, and it's believed to be a form of biological warfare against essentially third world countries.
Yeah. Cholera was used in Rhodesia as one of the biological weapons during the Rhodesian Civil War. Cholera showed up for the first time, I think, in 100 years in the Western Hemisphere, in Latin America, in Peru, around 1990. And mm-hmm. It may have been a biological weapon there. Cholera was brought in by UN so-called peacekeepers, a UN army into Haiti, and caused a massive outbreak in Haiti with many, many deaths. So cholera kills people. It's actually not that severe a disease, but it has one thing that's really bad, which is it causes this tremendous amount of diarrhea. It poisons a particular ATP pump. And if you can keep flowing water into people, if you can keep them drinking, or if you can put an IV in their arm, they will survive it because it doesn't do that much else. But it just dehydrates you rapidly.
It dehydrates, right.
Yeah, you produce gallons of diarrhea. And so if you have a third world country that has oral rehydration fluids, you just need sugar, salt, water, a little potassium, a little magnesium, sodium in the water, and just keep drinking that, you'll be okay. And it does respond to antibiotics also. There are vaccines. They are not, as far as I know, the old vaccines were not useful at all. They were at best 50% effective. And I don't know what they've got now. But I can tell you that the anthrax vaccine manufacturer bought up the cholera and typhoid vaccines. And so do not expect these to be high quality vaccines.
Okay, so now I'm going to turn to, I call it the new biodefense industrial complex, but my title here was Pathogen Plunder. And it was really you who got me to think of the technology of biowarfare and biodefense as a economic tool to do land grab and achieve resources and use it in very economic ways. And of course, we saw that with the pandemic. So we saw a huge economic taking, just unbelievable. But it was you and one other activist who got me to read 1,000+ pages of the WHO documents. And the first thing I discovered was the power of biosurveillance. And tell us a little bit about the WHO and biosurveillance.
So let me go back to the UN. So the UN had these peacekeepers in Haiti. They brought, some of them were from Bangladesh. They brought cholera, and the UN did not want to take responsibility. and did not take care of the Haitians, even though it's the UN. You would think they want to help these people. No, a lot of them died. Because essentially, if you can give them fluids, nobody will die of cholera.
From poor to desperate, cholera took not only Carolyn Pierre's husband, but also his income from farming. We have 7 kids to take care of. I don't even want to tell you how bad it is for me. In her village of Sodo, many have losses due to cholera, a deadly disease that until 2010, Haiti hadn't seen for nearly a century. They're among more than 5,000 people who filed a complaint with the United Nations peacekeeping operation known as MINUSTAH, looking for compensation.
MINUSTAH brought the disease. They should pay.
Several scientific studies point to this UN base as the place where cholera was introduced to Haiti. The unit of Nepalese soldiers suspected of carrying the bacteria have been quietly sent home. But Haitian courts have no jurisdiction over the UN. Under the UN's agreement with Haiti and other governments, only the UN can decide if and when it should pay damages. To make payouts, there has to be a standing claims commission. Now Al Jazeera has discovered the UN has never set one up, in Haiti or anywhere. UN officials have said nothing about the complaint filed 4 months ago by Haitian advocates.
The case is now in legal affairs in New York. We don't express any opinion.
The UN has never accepted responsibility for the cholera epidemic, even though its own investigation found that the outbreak stemmed from this river right next to its own base, which wasn't disposing of sewage properly.
The UN investigation found that Haiti's lack of water treatment facilities, made all the worse after a devastating earthquake, led to the rapid spread of the disease. It continues to spread, and more than 7,000 have died. While the report also says the exact source of the disease could not be determined, one of its authors says new information has since come to light.
Based on the summation of the circumstantial and scientific evidence, the most likely scenario is that someone associated with the UN MINUSTAH facility was the person responsible.
Acknowledging responsibility and compensating victims could cost the UN millions. But as an organization whose mission includes promoting accountability and the rule of law, not doing so could be just as costly to its reputation. Kristen Salumi, Al Jazeera, Sodo, Haiti.
So the UN was not your friend. And it turns out the WHO is not your friend. And the reason why is that these are captured agencies. The WHO budget is relatively small. It's about $4 billion a year. And so for Bill Gates, that's basically chicken feed. Or for right. your taxes, that's chicken feed. So wealthy countries and wealthy institutions, Bill Gates funds the WHO through a number of different charities, so-called philanthropies. Bill Gates gives a lot of money, for instance, to the Rotary Club. And then the Rotary Club is given about $1 billion to the WHO.
And they enjoy tax exemptions that most of us don't.
Exactly.
Don't
have. Right. This whole philanthropy business has to. Once the people get in control of our governments, we need to look at philanthropy. But anyway, so what happened is that people realized they could take over the WHO, and through the mechanism of fear, health, public health, the fear of pandemics, they had the potential to create 2 treaties at the WHO that nations would sign to increase the amount of biosurveillance and supposedly prevent or ameliorate another COVID epidemic. And so a narrative was created that the reason we suffered so much from COVID was not because the supranational powers were restricting the right medicines, forcing us to take the wrong things and keeping us in our houses so we couldn't perform economic activity to impoverish us. No, that wasn't the problem. The problem was that the rich countries didn't give the poor countries enough vaccines. And so to solve that problem, we have to create treaties that will, in the name of equity and fairness, share equally. No African will be left behind in terms of vaccines in the future. So a pandemic treaty was developed That means groups, appointed people, and in some cases, nations could appoint people to committees, and these committees that were overseen by WHO minders essentially would write drafts of a pandemic treaty. And this has been done for the last couple of years. And also the idea was that there would be major amendments to something called the International Health Regulations, which was a set of health regulations started in the late 1960s that really had very little to do with anything, more than ships docking in a port and winding up with infected animals or infected people. And what do you do in that situation? However, Gro Harlem Brundtland had been the WHO director general in the early 2000s, and she brought a lot of amendments to that document, which really didn't seem to have a whole lot of impact at the time. But now looking back, you can see that they were leading to the amendments that were brought up over the last 2 years.
Right.
And they did give the director general of the WHO the ability to declare pandemics or public health emergencies of international concern. Those rules that she instituted also, another thing that got instituted at the same time were the sleeper contracts between nations and vaccine manufacturers, which said that when the director general of the WHO calls at that time it was a pandemic level six, when that person says we have a pandemic level six, all these vaccine contracts will be triggered. And the vaccine manufacturers will make vaccines for whatever the pandemic is that we've got at that point, and the nations will pay whatever they've agreed to pay ahead of time when that happens. So in 2009, the director general, who was then Margaret Chan, called a level six pandemic. What people didn't realize is all the definitions had changed, and a level six pandemic could be anything, could be a new cold. And so she called it, she triggered these sleeper contracts, and many billions of dollars had to be spent on vaccines for the swine flu H1N1 epidemic of 2009 and 2010, which turned out to be less severe than a normal seasonal flu.
Right.
And a lot of people got sick from the vaccines, in particular narcolepsy in adolescents. So the WHO was captured even at that time.
What year was that?
So these sleeper contracts were being negotiated starting around 2004, and 2009 was when she pulled the trigger.
Right. And I remember the Massachusetts mandated. They were trying to get the states to mandate, and Massachusetts was the only one, I think, that did it. And there was such an uproar in all the states, you know, that finally that was part of why they backed off.
Yeah, New York mandated that vaccine for healthcare workers, and there were several lawsuits.
Gary Null brought one of those lawsuits. He was in New York.
Oh, did Gary? Okay, yeah. I know some other people who brought. That's good. Gary just has a book coming out in the next couple of weeks.
Oh, does he? Yeah, he's been fighting this for decades. Yeah, yeah. Okay, so what I realized when I read the WHO documents, there are a couple things that were very important, but one was it gave them powers to do very invasive surveillance within a local area.
Right.
So, and now it would be the WHO working through a national office.
Right.
So in theory, it would be the federal office, but basically they had the ability to surveil a neighborhood at a molecular level. Is that fair to say?
My reading of those documents is that the granular part of the surveillance was never specified. So the WHO had the ability to force nations, had the pandemic treaty and the amendments as desired gone through. They didn't. But if they had, the WHO could direct nations to perform various kinds of surveillance, including requiring nations to have genetic sequencing laboratories so that they would sequence potential pathogens, viruses, and then put the sequences online. Yeah, they could surveil wastewater, all sorts of things, but they, they could, animals and people. But they never, there were these kinds of potentially very egregious provisions were never made granular.
Right.
In the documents. But yes, they had the ability to do all sorts of things because, well, we're going to prevent pandemics. So what do we do to prevent pandemics? You got to look for them everywhere, all the
time. Well, but the beauty of it is if you have a team of 20 scientists coming from the WHO or the federal office, and they all have fancy degrees, how are you, a farmer, supposed to prove that what they're saying is hooey and do it fast?
And because this is a very important point that I've been looking into the last few days. So with COVID, nobody was allowed in the beginning to develop a test. Only the CDC's test could be used for the first 2 months of COVID in the United States. And then after that, the FDA said, well, okay, other people can do tests, make up tests, but you have to send us the paperwork, and the paperwork takes at least a week to fill out, and then we might let you. And then by about around the 20th of March, there were basically no tests because the CDC tests didn't work. And I think that was a plan. So by about March 20th, the FDA just said, anyone who has a test, just push it out there and use it, and we'll figure out if it works later. Of course, they never figured it out.
Right.
So over 300 tests were allowed to be brought in. Well, now we've got bird flu, same deal. Only the states can test at the first level. So you can buy a commercial test for bird flu for your flock if you want, but it doesn't count. You know, you've got to rely on the state, their public health laboratory, and then it gets confirmed by either the CDC or by the USDA. No one else can confirm bird flu. So you're a farmer and you think all your chickens are healthy, but you're within a certain radius of somewhere where they say there's bird flu. They're coming in and testing your flock or your cow.
Right. All you need is one fake test, one false positive, and you've got to kill a million birds.
Yes.
It's ridiculous.
Exactly. It's crazy. It's a taking.
Right.
So far, they've gotten away with it because they've paid for all the birds. They come in, they tell you to kill all the birds, and then they pay so that in 2023, the U.S. government paid over $500 million for
so
birds.
What I've read is they've killed 92 million birds as of a couple weeks ago.
So since February of 2022, 99 million birds in the U.S.,
okay.
But I think if you go back 20 years or 25 years, because this all started in 1997 in Hong Kong. So if you go through the world, it's about 500 million birds.
Jesus. So I sent you this little little thing that I got on Telegram that was showing, you know, how many of each fish and how many of each animal we eat. And according to their statistics, the two top livestock in the world are number one chickens and number two cattle. And those are the ones we see absolutely targeted by a variety of mechanisms, the biggest one being bird flu. I mean, bird flu is the poor man's steak, right?
Yes.
So if we kill all the chickens, we're not going to have any chicken and we're not going to have any eggs.
And the bird flu hasn't moved into other animals, but it certainly could. I mean, they found it in seals. They found it in all sorts of animals. And so once the U.S. government says, you know, okay, it's in whatever, it's in goats now, it's the same, it's going to be the same deal. And as I pointed out, you can't fight back because you don't have a test. You don't know, there's no way you can say, no, my animal doesn't have this.
Right.
The other thing is that no milk has been found in the United States to have any live bird flu. On the one hand, they're doing PCR tests of milk and saying we're finding bird flu because they're looking for these very short segments, 20 or so nucleotides. Oh, yeah, that's a bird flu segment. Well, it may be a bird flu segment, but it may come from something else. You don't know. They're not telling you what the PCR test is. They don't tell you what they're using. And again, I was online yesterday looking. Was FDA and CDC telling us what tests they use? No, they refer you to this published paper and that published paper, but they're using some version of it. It's not exactly the same, and they won't share. Why won't they share? And companies are saying, look, we want to make bird flu tests. There's 20 companies saying, let us make bird flu tests. And nobody's got the permission to do that yet.
So I want to talk about emergencies and then come back to bird flu in this fall. One of the most important things to defeat is the power to create, to manufacture an emergency that then skips over lots of rules and lots of protocols and lots of laws because it's an emergency. So, you know, so the states have not delegated healthcare policy to the federal government. It's reserved for the states. But yet when the states try and take the position, we're in charge of healthcare, the federal government says, it's an emergency, we're in charge. So, and the problem with tests that are controlled by the FDA, and they say there's a bird flu epidemic when we say, well, we don't trust you and we don't trust your tests.
Yes.
Is they can fake an emergency.
Exactly.
Right.
I mean, they're essentially faking the bird flu emergency because nobody's gotten bird flu from milk. Nobody's gotten bird flu from eating chicken. There are 5 cases in the United States of humans who allegedly had bird flu. 5. 4 of them had pink eye, and 1 had fatigue, and 1 had a cough. And that's it. None of them had to go to the hospital. None of them died. You know, the WHO has documented that since 2020, since the beginning of 2020, in the whole world, supposedly only 8 people have died from bird flu.
Well, you know, one of the star witnesses was a death in Mexico, and the Mexican health secretary yes. stood up and announced, no, he didn't die of the bird flu. I mean, it's
exactly.
It was,
so right. It may be less than 8 because that was a different bird flu. It wasn't an H5N1, but also that person was in the hospital for weeks. And then at some point they got tested for bird flu and it was positive, but they were sick from all these other things. They're on their way, you know, they're on death's door. There was also a child in India that was tested, was in the hospital for a long time. And during that child's illness, the child tested positive for 4 different viruses. The last one, again, was a bird flu. So WHO is announcing it. I was like, okay.
But why would they test a child in the hospital for a long period of time with birth? I mean, it doesn't.
Well, probably governments are looking for cases, right?
Right.
So they're going to their friends in hospitals and saying, you know, give us specimens so we can test them. Now, the CDC has been observing 12,000 humans who work on farms who've been in contact with chickens or cows.
Right.
And it's of these 12,000 people that they finally came up with 5 who got sick. The thing is, bird flu changed. It mutated. It used to be a deadly disease in humans, and now it isn't. But everyone's pretending that it's still that deadly disease that it was 20 years ago. And that's the big fake out.
Okay, so we know there's an effort to control the food supply.
Right.
And we know there's an effort to grab land. I mean,
yes.
It seems to me that bird flu...
And impoverish small farmers.
Right, exactly. This is a way that, you know, this is a... First, you get the taxpayer to play, to pay for the whole thing. You make money on the, you know, so on creating the bird flu, creating the tests, creating the vaccines, creating the whole... You know, it's big business for everybody. A lot of activity. Then you make money on putting the small farmers out, consolidating the market share, and grabbing the land cheap.
Exactly.
It's plunder pathogens, or pathogen plunder is what I'm calling it. But
yes, I mean, there's so many other viruses out there. They could pick another one and just go looking around for it and find, yeah, a few chickens here and there and cows have it. Maybe people have it. So what? So the government paid for, you know, all these chickens, 100 million chickens to be culled.
Uh-huh.
Well, they've decided they don't want to pay for the cows. So now the cows are allowed. You can move the cows, take them out of your milking herd, and then you can bring them back in a few weeks when they've gotten over it.
Oh, so, that's good.
Yeah. So that is a good thing.
Where did that sanity get in? Who did that?
Well, I think they realized they couldn't afford to pay for all the cows. 500 million for chickens, you know?
Well, no, but they're going to tag the cows. That's how they're going to get the profit there. They're going to try and do the tagging. Okay, now, here's the thing. You know, so we're describing a government and various actors who are becoming more and more and more, let's just use the word, greater and greater hubris and more takings. Now, they're not alone in the world. There are lots of countries, there are 190 countries around the world watching this or somehow participating in the WHO. And why would they, you know, so I've been told the U.S. has 300 plus bio labs, or whatever you want to call them, around the world. We know we had 46 in the Ukraine because Victoria Nuland had to come clean when the Russians invaded because they were worried about
Right, they overtook some of them. Yes.
Yeah, they overtook some of them. So, and lots of rumors about what was going on in those. But, you know, but you have many other countries around the world saying, well, if they're going to do it and not have to obey the treaty, why should we?
Yes. Well, this is another interesting thing I had no idea of before I started looking at the WHO. Turns out the United States added caveats in its treaty, in when it signed treaties with the WHO before, starting in 1948, when the WHO was formed. The United States government said, look, we're going to go along with what you tell us when we can. But sometimes the states have authority over health, and we won't be able to order them what to do. And so all we can do is promise that we'll make a recommendation. Isn't that amazing?
That's amazing.
And they've put other caveats in. So they push on these treaties, and then they give themselves back doors. And that was done when we signed the International Health Regulation Amendments in 2006, the last time. And I think that the other countries don't really realize that these things are happening. Or, you know, I mean, remember, there were scandals decades ago when the United States was, you know, had a wire, was eavesdropping on all these different embassies around the UN in New York.
The German magazine Der Spiegel and Britain's Guardian newspaper claim to have evidence showing that the United States National Security Agency bugged the European Union mission in New York and its embassy in Washington. The EU summoned the US ambassador and ordered a sweep of its offices to check for devices. Stefan Seibert, a spokesperson for German Chancellor Angela Merkel, said Washington needs to explain.
It has to be cleared up, and if it turned out to be true, that would be unacceptable. We are no longer in the Cold War.
On a trip to Brunei Monday, U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry was questioned about the allegations.
I will say that every country in the world that is engaged in international affairs of national security undertakes lots of activities to protect its national security, and all kinds of information contributes to that. And all I know is that that is not unusual for lots of nations.
Leaked documents allege that the NSA taps 500 million phone calls and emails in Germany in a typical month. David Cadier is from the Ideas Analyst Group at the London School of Economics.
It might turn into an EU internal problem. It might be that the problem is less the fact that US authorities have been spying on some EU delegations, offices, some embassies. But I think the key problem will be rather the issue of personal data sharing.
The allegations come as Europe and the United States are beginning negotiations on creating the world's biggest free trade agreement. Again, David Cadier of LSE.
Will it be put in jeopardy in the end? I don't think so, because the level of support among the EU officials, among European governments for this trade has been quite strong.
One document lists 38 other embassies where spying has allegedly taken place, including Mexico, Japan, South Korea, India and Turkey. The documents were leaked by former NSA contractor Edward Snowden.
And I'm sure basically people like the US government, Bill Gates, have the inside line on what every country is telling their diplomat to do. In addition, it was identified there were two countries whose diplomats, the Russian and the Italian, were actually going along with the WHO and these two treaties when their nations didn't want them.
Right.
And so these were probably captured diplomats, you know, bribed or whatever, diplomats. And then you wonder, well, how many of them are there? Apparently, there's lots of them.
Mm-hmm.
Because they may come from a poor country, you know, but they like it in Geneva. Maybe they can, you know, get a sinecure in Geneva.
Right.
So the WHO also has these methods, these fraudulent methods for, I call them fraud, for conducting votes. They don't like votes. They hate votes. They don't.
They just pretend they have them.
They pretend.
They pretend, right.
So they want consensus, and they get everybody to agree ahead of time. Well, you're going to give us consensus. So you're not going to break the consensus, even if you don't like it, but don't break the consensus. And I've been told that there were times a delegate stood on his desk going like this, and they refused to acknowledge him when he tried to break consensus.
Well, didn't the Netherlands just send a letter saying you can't say that it's been approved because we didn't vote yes? And
yeah, so this again, so the parliament had voted at one time, the lower house in Netherlands, not to go along with these two treaties, and the Minister of Health said, you know, hey, I don't have to listen to you. I'm the Minister of Health. And so then Parliament came back and said, wait a minute. No. You've got to do what we tell you. You either vote no or it's delayed, but you can't vote yes. And finally, then after a lot of pressure, the Minister of Health said, okay, well, we're changing governments, because this was already after the vote.
Right.
And so we're changing government. So we're going to leave it to the next government to decide what they do with the WHO. But this is the kind of thing that happens, is that the people who decide on the votes are not necessarily obeying the rules of their nation.
So this is why if you only subscribe to one Substack to understand what's going on at the WHO, it has to be yours. Because you have done a great job all the way along about saying they're going to say they have the vote and they don't. Don't let them get away with this. So you've done a great job of keeping the gaslighting from getting anywhere.
Thank you.
So I have to bring up one other thing about the WHO that is, you know, it's one of the funniest things I've ever heard, but it's not funny. It's terrifying, but it's so bad that you just can't believe it. And if you hadn't been the person to tell me, I just couldn't have believed it. Tell everybody about the pathogen sharing program.
Oh my God. Yes. this was so unbelievable. I didn't believe it either. I had to read it many times. So what was proposed in the pandemic treaty, and again, there were 9 drafts, so each draft was a little different. But what was proposed was that the United Nations would have a network of laboratories that would collect all the so-called potential pandemic pathogens, aka biological warfare agents, or, you know, gain-of-function organisms. And they would, in one draft, they actually said they would supervise gain-of-function research on these. That a hand-picked group of scientists picked by the director general would supervise gain of function. But then the WHO was then going to loan these out, basically share them with interested parties.
Like a lending library.
Like a lending library.
Like a lending
library. What they were going to do is universities, pharmaceutical companies, research centers, all could be given these biological warfare agents to do research on, so that not necessarily just when there's a pandemic and you're desperate, you know, we need tests, we need drugs, so we give out the organism so we can get those things. No, all the time we're going to give this stuff out. Not only that,
so everybody can play with them, right?
So everyone can play with it.
Play with them.
And nations are required to put the sequence online. So anyone who knows how to hack can then get the sequence and then give the sequence to your friendly biologist, who can then create the virus for you, de novo. The whole thing was completely insane. The WHO already started it without gaining permission from the, you know, their, what do you call it, the World Health Assembly. So there is already a memorandum of understanding between the WHO and a lab in Spiez, Switzerland, to be the first laboratory in this lab network of potential pandemic pathogens. This was just proliferation of biological weapons. It's against the Biological Weapons Convention. It's against a Security Council memorandum at the UN 1540. It's against common law, you know, regular law in the world, against. Yeah, I mean, it's completely crazy. Why would you want to share all of these different biological warfare agents around the world? It made no sense unless they were planning to have one pandemic after another and blame it on lab leaks. You know, oh, we gave it to you know, Timbuktu.
If I were them, I would collect a copy of everything into Switzerland, and then I would have a hiccup and say, oh, no, we have to stop. Let's just do this. Let's wait. And then nobody gets to borrow it, but you know,
yes,
the lab in Switzerland has one of everything.
That very, very good point. Very
right.
good point.
So it's like the seed bank in Norway, right? Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, so let's talk about what we can do about this, because I think I happen to believe one of the things we can do about it is just face the fact that this is going on.
Yes.
And stop treating the players as if they're credible. I mean, it's not credible. It's dangerous, but it's not. These are not. I mean, if you look at all the players, certainly at the governmental level, who are using our tax dollars to do this, they have proven themselves not to be trustworthy.
Right. And incompetent. And they. So the first thing I want to say to the audience is that, OK, there's all these biological weapons out there, but the really bad ones are uncontrollable. And so the bad guys are not going to be using them because they won't be able to control them. Their families could get harmed too. So let's put those aside for a moment. There are lab leaks. There have been a lot of lab leaks. None of them have led to large outbreaks. And that's a good thing. We need fewer labs or no labs. I'd be in favor of no gain of function labs. But I don't think right now, historically, people have been doing this kind of work for almost 100 years, actually 100 years, and lab leaks are not the biggest problem. For almost all of these organisms, there are potential drugs that will work. What we saw with COVID is the governments knew about some of those drugs and suppressed them.
Right.
But vitamin D was actually critically important. Almost everybody that wound up in an ICU with COVID was vitamin D deficient or relatively mm-hmm. low. And so there are simple things you can do to improve your health. And there will be, no matter what pandemic hits us, there will be doctors and scientists who can figure out treatments. Mm-hmm. And you have to keep your eye on them and don't worry that this is the end of the world. For COVID, it turned out the NIAID had actually done a study with NIAID scientists. Fauci paid for this study. Part of it was conducted at Fort Detrick, where they looked at all these different drugs, thousands or hundreds of drugs. Could they kill SARS-1, the original SARS from China? Could they kill SARS-1 or MERS, which is the camel disease in Saudi Arabia that's a cousin of COVID? They're both cousins. They're all beta coronaviruses. Could they kill them with these different drugs? And they did these studies in tissue culture, and they found 66 different drugs that killed one or the other or both of
wow.
these two viruses in tissue culture. And so Fauci and his agency knew all about this 5 years before COVID. They published this in 2014, 66 different drugs. And among them were chloroquine and hydroxychloroquine. I don't think ivermectin was tested. So that just goes to show you that if governments are not withholding these things, there are medicines that are almost certainly going to be going right. to work. CDC and FDA have looked at the bird flu, and because bird flu is an influenza A virus. So it's a mm-hmm. cousin of the seasonal flu that humans get. And the old drug for that was amantadine. And the new drug, which doesn't work very well, is oseltamivir or Tamiflu.
Right.
And drugs like it. The bird flu that they found, the H5N1, does not have the genes for resistance to either of those two drugs. So amantadine will probably work for bird flu. They've given Tamiflu to the five people who...
You mean if more than eight people get it?
Yeah, if more than eight people or five people get it. I mean, there are probably multiple drugs. Vitamin D is very, very helpful for preventing and making less severe respiratory infections. Everyone should have a high vitamin D level.
Right.
What they say is normal is 30. I had a level of 30 or 35 before. That was not normal for me. My level's 100 now. I get much, much fewer colds and flus and all of that. So don't worry about pandemics. It's so frightening when you think about it and you don't have a framework for understanding them. That's what makes them frightening.
Well, what is frightening to me is the bird flu vaccine.
That's frightening.
It was the same with COVID. I said, don't worry about COVID, worry about the injection. So there is a tremendous effort to make and push and sell bird flu vaccines. And my impression is that a lot have been made already. Is that...
In the United States, there are three licensed vaccines for H5N1. Probably they're all dangerous. And so the U.S. government has recently given contracts to Seqirus and to Sanofi for H5N8 vaccines that they think may work. Seqirus and Moderna. Sanofi has one of the other vaccines, the old ones. So that's five different vaccines for this bird flu that the U.S. government is spending your tax dollars on. Now, one of the earlier ones in the clinical trial, there were 100 people in the clinical trial. One died, one got breast cancer, one had a stroke, one had a bleeding disorder. They stopped developing that one, but they gave it a license anyway because they said, well, bird flu is killing 60% of the people who get it. But of course, it doesn't anymore. It doesn't kill anybody anymore. But that was the excuse. So FDA has to balance risk and benefit. So if the risk is a 60% death rate, well, if the vaccine only kills 4%, maybe okay. The second vaccine, or actually, it was the third vaccine, is called starts with an A. Audenz. It is a Seqirus vaccine. And they had a larger clinical trial and 0.5%. So they had a few thousand people in the clinical trial, and 11 of them who got Audenz died versus 1,000 who were in the placebo group. So we've got these vaccines stockpiled. They're ready to go, but the United States is now putting money into newer ones. And I think they're hoping that the newer ones will be less deadly than these two old ones. When you're making vaccines for an emergency, then efficacy and safety go by the board. They just sort of, let's throw something together. And there were also other scams for licensing these products. So along with this deal where you call a level 6, pandemic and then anything goes with the new vaccines, there was also a scam called mock-up vaccines, where you create a vaccine for some future pandemic, you have no idea if it's going to work. You just create it and you go through the motions. So you develop a big package of data. You give that data to the FDA. FDA gives it a license. No one ever expects to use it. And then when the real pandemic comes, you say, I'm going to make a vaccine using the same platform as that last one. That's licensed already. I can just grandfather in this one and just change out the antigen a little bit. And that's what they do. So they've got the mock-up vaccine licensed. And then this is all, basically to avoid liability, to make everything legal and kosher. But it means that under these circumstances, do not expect either vaccines to work or be safe, because it's very unlikely that they will.
Okay, so these vaccines are coming into a situation where we've had a series of things happen for the last 3 to 5 years, which are causing people to be less healthy. So let's say I got two of the Pfizer shots and boosters, and that has weakened my system in a variety of ways, or given me more toxicity, or I've been eating the food that Whole Foods takes out of the trash, or I don't know if you saw, I sent you that video.
Yes.
So I'm ingesting a lot of spray and whatever. All these different things have caused me to be weaker. I've never followed the Belgian virologist, Gert Bosch, I think is his name. But somebody sent me, a subscriber sent me an email the other day and said, he said, you know, now the vaccine deaths are going to go off the charts and he's gone into hiding because he doesn't want to be around when it happens. So whatever.
He's been saying that for 4 years.
I know. But I never heard he was in hiding before, but that's secondhand. So that's all I can tell you. But you know, whatever the reason, whatever, you know, if you load people up with a serious flu, let alone another round of injections, you're loading it on top of a population that's been weakened.
Right. Exactly.
Right.
And that's a problem. Because people are getting more infections, more cancer, more heart attacks, and we don't know what's going to happen. I mean, what synergism there is.
So, but here's what I think you said, and I think it gets back to the vitamin D. There is a great deal we can do to make sure we're healthy. So I've told you this. One of my favorite moments in the Salieri Report is I was interviewing Dr. Gwen Scott about how to protect our health from whatever is in the spray. And she said to me when I gave her, I did a pre-interview and then I put it into a list of the 10 things you can do. And she listened to me lay out the 10 things. And she said, well, dear, that's good, but you forgot the most important one. And I said, what's that? She said, if you look at what's going on, we should be dead, but we're not. So something else is going on and I call it grace. And so, you know, I always tell people I have an image of Mr. Global sitting up there saying, you know, how come they're still so healthy and vital? And, you know, why can't I? So I do think something else is going on. And so if you will have an intention to be healthy and really work at being healthy, you know, I think a lot can happen. So now let's turn to your effort to protect the food supply, what you're doing. And I also want to talk a little bit about federal and state legislators, because I think there's a tremendous amount that can be done after the success with the WHO last year and other successes in the state. I mean, we even had the Tennessee legislature, you know, require vaccine lettuce to have to be sold through pharmacies and pass a law against the spraying. I just saw the first response of the agency at Tennessee is supposed to enforce the law about spraying, having to explain to the person who was writing that they didn't have jurisdictions of planes that were flying, you know, that took off and landed outside the state. So if they just flew across, they have no jurisdiction. It's very clever. So they're grappling with the jurisdictional and the enforcement issues. But tell us a little bit about the food supply, why you care so much, and what you and Door to Freedom are going to be doing.
Thanks. So there are a whole lot of different attacks coming from different directions and for different reasons on food and agriculture. And we've talked about some of them today, but also this great reset that Klaus Schwab talks about, that these people who think they have the right to rule the world are attempting to, or sort of certainly talking about, and our governments are, again, spending our tax dollars on finding ways to make foods out of bizarre things like bugs and plastics and garbage. why they would want to do this, I mean, I think really part of the reason is to debase, to degrade us, to make us almost feel subhuman, that we don't deserve to have real food. We are fighting the whole Great Reset. We are fighting the globalists, whoever they are, who are trying to take over, gain the resources, presumably reduce the population. The people who gave the order to vaccinate for COVID and continue to vaccinate with these poisonous vaccines. The people who may have released the COVID virus onto the population. Well, so we're dealing with an industrial food supply in the United States that has continuously degraded the quality of the food, you know, during my lifetime and yours. And there are many laws and rules and regulations that have enabled that to happen. But finally, people are waking up and realizing that we do have epidemics of obesity, diabetes, heart attacks, et cetera, that are food related, and that a lot of this can potentially be fixed. You know, that, for instance, the FDA has gone after raw milk for almost 40 years. People find that raw milk is more nutritious than pasteurized milk. My son, for example, has been convinced by whatever, not even to feed his children milk, but to give them oat milk or soy milk or all kinds of, you know. Yes.
Almonds. And he has very impressive credentials. He's a doctor, right?
He's a cardiologist.
Oh, my Lord.
You know, but he's thinking cholesterol. Milk has a lot of cholesterol. This is what, unfortunately, doctors have been taught. Me, I wouldn't drink raw milk because we had it drilled into us that raw milk was dangerous. Boy, it was almost nobody's gotten sick from it. So anyway, it's very important that people be healthy. And what they require for that is nutritious and healthy food that hasn't been contaminated. And it's important. It's a way in to understand the Great Reset and what's being done to us. And it's a nonpartisan issue. Mm-hmm. So for all those reasons, and because we think we have a great strategy, we're going to use the same strategy we used with the WHO, which is you work with the grassroots, but you also work with the lawmakers at the state level and at the national level. And
you had great success at the national level.
We've been amazed. Like, you know, you need a few champions. We had Ron Johnson, who was our champion at the national level.
I can't say enough good things about Ron Johnson. I don't know if you remember when we were there in Washington and Johnson came in and he was talking about why it was going to be impossible to make real progress on the vaccine issue. And I said to him, Senator, you know, that's, if you believe that's true, why do you keep pushing and not give up and have these hearings and do everything you're doing? And he said, I didn't want to come back last time. If they vote me out, what do I care? He said, this is no fun. You have no idea how dysfunctional this place is, because he didn't know I'd work there. But, you know, he was basically saying, I'm going to do the right thing and I don't care what people say. I'm just going to do it. Yeah.
And I mean, he was distraught because he said two or three of his colleagues had admitted to him that they had vaccine injuries from the COVID vaccines. Yes, he said that at that meeting, and they wouldn't speak up. They wouldn't come forward.
So Nancy Mace did. And what a brave, courageous, fabulous job she did.
Yes, but she's the only one. But apparently there's plenty of them that are vaccine injured.
Wow. Oh, that's heartbreaking.
I, along with many Americans, have long-term effects from COVID. Not only was I a long hauler, but I have effects from the vaccine. It wasn't the first shot, but it was the second shot that I now developed asthma that has never gone away since I had the second shot. I have tremors in my left hand, and I have the occasional heart pain that no doctor can explain, and I've had a battery of tests. I find it extremely alarming Twitter's unfettered censorship spread into medical fields and affected millions of Americans by suppressing expert opinions from doctors and censoring those who disagree with the CDC. I have great regrets about getting the shot because of the health issues that I now have that I don't think are ever going to go away. And I know that I'm not the only American who has those kinds of concerns. Another example of what Twitter has done to censor folks is from Dr. Martin Kulldorff, a Harvard-educated epidemiologist, who once tweeted, COVID vaccines are important for high-risk people and their caretakers. Those with prior natural infection do not need it, nor children. The Twitter files reveal this tweet was deemed false information because it ran contrary to the CDC. So my first question this morning of Ms. Gatti, may I ask of you, where did you go to medical school?
I did not go to medical school.
I'm sorry?
I did not go to medical school.
That's what I thought. Why do you think you or anyone else at Twitter had the medical expertise to censor a doctor's expert opinion?
Our policies regarding COVID were designed to protect individuals. We were seeing
you guys censored Harvard-educated doctors, Stanford-educated doctors, doctors that are educated in the best places in the world, and you silenced those voices. My next question is, did the U.S. government, I have another chart I want to show you, Ms. Gatti. I have another tweet by someone with a following of a full 18,000 followers. This person put a chart from the CDC on Twitter. It's the CDC's own data, so it's accurate by your standards. And you all labeled this as misleading. You're not a doctor, right, Ms. Gatti?
No, I'm not.
Okay. What makes you think you or anyone else of Twitter have the medical expertise to censor actual, accurate CDC data?
I'm not familiar with these particular situations.
Yeah, I'm sure you're not. But this is what Twitter did. They labeled this as inaccurate. It is the government's own data. It's ridiculous that we're even having to have this conversation today. It's not just about the laptop. This is about medical advice that expert doctors were trying to give Americans because social media companies like Twitter were silencing their voices. I have another question, my last one for you, Ms. Gatti. Did the U.S. government ever contact you or anyone at Twitter to pressure Twitter to moderate or censor certain tweets? Yes or no?
We have a program.
Did the U.S. government ever contact you or anyone at Twitter to censor or moderate certain tweets? Yes or no?
We receive legal demands to remove content from the platform from the U.S. government and governments all around the world. Those are published on a third-party website, and anyone can review them.
Thank God for Matt Taibbi. Thank God for Elon Musk for allowing to show us in the world that Twitter was basically a subsidiary of the FBI, censoring real medical voices with real expertise that put real Americans' lives in danger because they didn't have that information.
And, you know, here was the funny thing. It's when the financial crisis came along and Hank Paulson, who was had been the head of Goldman Sachs, was the head of Treasury, he announced that he was not going to save AIG, was going to let them go bankrupt. Well, AIG was the largest repository outside of the Department of Justice of black budget legal documents. I knew there was no, they ran the book on reinsuring all the black budget litigation at Department of Justice, or a lot of it at Department of Justice. I knew there was no way you could let them go down. It was impossible. But what scared me when I saw him say that, I realized, oh my God, I understand his portfolio better than Hank Paulson, who's chairman, you know, was just finished being chairman of the Goldman Sachs. If he doesn't know that, now think back. When the pandemic started, I dare say you and I knew, you know, that the injection was going to be dangerous. Think about what it means that U.S. senators and congressmen didn't know that.
Exactly.
Right.
Exactly.
Right. I mean, it's a little like having a president for 6 months who's not there. I don't know if you saw, there was one report, you know, the gloves are off now. There was one reporter the other day said, okay, well, the president says, you know, he's fine before 8 p.m. Let's say the Pentagon calls up after 8 and a missile's incoming. Who do you call? The first lady? I mean, who's going to handle that?
Yes.
And the press secretary got so mad, she just stood up and walked away. But you know, of all the irresponsible things I've seen happen in Washington, the idea that the cabinet and the congressional leadership would allow this situation to go on for 6 months tells you something.
I think it's gone on for 3.5 years myself.
Yeah, that's fair. That's fair.
But I mean, certainly, I think it comes and goes.
Right. Right. And so now you can see how things like a lending library of all the pathogens in the world can happen. Okay, so how do we support you? If we go to Door to Freedom, we can sign up for your newsletter.
Please do, yes.
And sign up for your Substack.
Yes.
Yeah.
And MerrillNass.substack.com, DoorToFreedom.org.
Uh-huh.
That's our website. So it's got tons of information on the hoop. And now we are building up the website on the attack on food. And uh-huh. We will be having a second symposium that my board members and I put together, a symposium in March, March 4th, 2023 on the attack on food. And so we're doing another one on September 7th and probably a second day. It looks like we've got too many speakers already, and we're hoping Catherine will open the event.
I'm going to do what you tell me. I just need to know the date so I can check my schedule to make sure I'm not on a plane or something. But
fabulous. Or you can do it ahead of time if you need to.
Can we stream it? Can all the other websites stream it?
Yes.
Okay.
We
it was absolutely excellent. And And of course, near and dear to my heart is the raw milk effort, because if you look at the, we have a series of articles about what the Weston Price folks, Pete Kennedy, Sally Fallon Morrell, that whole group have done really over the last 25 years to get, it's legal for pets or humans in 46 states, I think. And if you look at, you know, they came up from very few up to 46, and they fought that fight in the trenches year after year after year, and we can't let that get rolled back. We're going to make for the, I think the hero next week is the farmer from California who's got the Raw Milk Foundation and has done such an amazing job.
Mark McAfee.
Yeah, he's great.
He is great. He's going to be a speaker. Yes.
Fabulous. He's great. So he's going to be hero of the week this week. Anyway, I dare say, I think many of your speakers have been hero of the week on the Salir Report, including you. So, ladies and gentlemen, this is a very dark topic. Meryl always goes at the toughest fights. But one thing I will promise you is if you sign up for a Substack, you will laugh a lot. You keep your state of amusement.
Well, you could call it sarcasm. No, I think you're right. No, I have a good spiritual grounding. I do believe that the universe, there's no way I could accomplish what I'm accomplishing now if the universe wasn't feeding me all the time.
Right.
And I am very grateful for that. I'm grateful that I've got my health back, and I'm grateful to be able to be a part of this transition we're going through to create a better world when we come out the other end. And happy to wake up every morning. So, I that's the best tonic of all.
Yes, yes. So one of my pastors used to always say, if you woke up with your right mind this morning, you have a reason to give him praise. Okay, well, ladies and gentlemen, thank you for joining us on the Salir Report. You now have a great source and a framework for thinking about biowarfare and biodefense. And, you know, it's absolutely dreadful, but I think the more we bring transparency to this, the more we can do something about it. So, Dr. Meryl Ness, thank you for everything you do. We're in cahoots. Let me know more about what's going on in September 7th, and I'll do everything I can to support you. So,
thank you. Thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, have a wonderful day.